Today's episode of A Novel Podcast is sponsored by Audible, and today's novels, Spook and Packing for Mars by Mary Roach, are available through audible.com's audio library. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and I'll be joined today by my wife, Sarah, and our good friend, Andrew. And today we are going to do a deep dive examination of the movie adaptation of the book Ready Player One by Ernest Cline. Now, a couple of episodes ago, we discussed the novel in great detail. Then we all went out and watched the movie, and we have some comments that we're going to be making about it. Now, fair warning, as always, we will be giving spoilers away for the movie and the book in this episode, so if you have not seen or read either the novel nor the movie, I would recommend going out and reading one and watching the other before you continue on with this episode. This is a little bit of a shorter episode because mostly we are just talking about the novel and its film adaptation, but in the same time, we do go into a great amount of detail, so I hope you enjoy it, and here it is. We did discuss Ready Player One as a novel a few months ago. And then, of course, the movie came out shortly thereafter. And we've all gone to see the movie. So we've got Sarah and Andrew here with us. Sarah, would you like to start with your amusing anecdote about your experience with the movie?
I'm not sure how amusing it is. But I gave up drinking for a time, 40 days before Easter. And I gave up drinking entirely. So it was sort of a big deal that we were going to go have a beer before seeing Ready Player One, or a drink. And we were in Pennsylvania, near where Russ and I got married. We decided, we were with a friend from college, we decided to go to our wedding reception venue. And I don't think they sell a lot of tap beer. It's just not that type of place, but that's really what I wanted to drink. So I got a beer on tap. They brought it from some other bar, even though we were sitting at the bar. I was a little confused by that. And shortly thereafter, while we were in the car going to the theater, I got really sick, to the point that I spent the majority of the movie with my head down, sort of between my knees, and I missed most of it. But the parts I did see, I didn't care for. So we can elaborate from there. So that was my... I mean, I don't know if I liked it even less, because it felt like the theater was swaying from side to side.
Understood.
I'm thinking it was dirty taps. That's my guess.
Right.
I've since drank and been fine.
So. I had a glass of scotch.
You had a glass of scotch.
But yes. I didn't really like the movie any more than you did. And the scotch was good scotch.
It was good scotch.
Scotch was probably the best part of the night.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Ready Player One.
Andrew, what did you think of the movie? What was your experience with it?
Yeah, I had similar feelings. I mean, the changes I wasn't a huge fan of. It kind of distracted me throughout the movie. It distanced itself from a couple key plot points that I really liked about the book. I mean, I like, it's funny because I've had a couple of different conversations with people, and I totally acknowledge the counter argument to my own opinion that is, that this was a total kind of like overarching, let's reference everything in nerd culture from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And Spielberg obviously had a lot of sway and contributed a lot to that canon in general. And so that was kind of one of the things that a lot of people harped on. They were like, oh, he was kind of going back to his roots and hitting those key points that really made him interested in film or made him a nerd to begin with. And at the same time, I always just think, oh, then why did he take out the Dungeons and Dragons portion of the book? But yes, so that was kind of like just wrapping it all together. I mean, it was good from a CGI perspective. It wasn't like so fake that I could kind of like understand why they chose to do it that way.
I would agree with you there.
That was impressive, but overall, yeah, it was not nearly as much of an enjoyment as when I was reading the actual book.
Have you, either of you, talked to anyone who didn't read the book but did see the movie?
Only one.
What did that one say?
He really liked it.
I So I've talked to several people who watched it and didn't read the book, and they all really liked it.
So is it just that as nerds, we're... I will fully own and fully admit to being extremely selective and picky about my source material. Like, I always like the book better. Almost always.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like people altering characters that I've come to love. I don't like superficial changes in the plot. Like, mm-hmm. there was no reason to take out the D&D element. You're already spending trillions of dollars on CGI.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that's an overestimate. I haven't priced out any CGI lately. But, like, that car race in the beginning, you could have easily done the D&D thing instead.
Right.
Yeah, and the whole car race just seemed to not really fit in with the motif of the Easter eggs to begin with. My personal opinion is that... okay, so you're going to make some changes. That's fine. You're going to make it a better movie than the book was a book. Or at least that's what you're going to aim for. That's all fine. But I don't think you achieved that with the changes that you made. I think you just made it less important and added a few plot holes that didn't need to be added.
The addition of plot holes.
Yeah. It made the challenges seem so simplistic. Like that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, especially when in the film he... just gets the coin from the main robot, or the archive robot.
Yes.
That in of itself took away from that kind of like tangent scene that he goes and when he plays the perfect Pac-Man game.
Yes.
Which is like another, like, to do that movie and not reference Pac-Man as well. It's like, come on. So that was kind of one of the things that he just drives backwards, and that's the way that he solves it. And he just gets to the copper key. And I was like, that was actually seemed pretty easy, when in reality he had to have like this insanely. Not only did he have to discover where it was on the planet, the Ludus planet where his school was,
mm-hmm.
but he also had to do like the Tomb of Horrors and then play the game of Joust as well. So
and
it
he had
like,
to have genuine knowledge of nerd culture.
Yeah.
Right.
The race didn't involve any knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah.
He just decided to go backwards.
The other thing was the whole way that Wade got started was really a Cinderella man story.
Yes.
He has no money. He can hardly even get off that planet. He can't level up. So he doesn't really have much of a place as a Gunter. And yet it was through his extreme knowledge and the fact that he was stuck on the school planet that led him to the first key in the first place. And that theme, I like that a lot. And it set up Wade as your everyman, as your good guy. Mm-hmm. And the movie just completely destroyed that. Wade was nothing in the movie.
Right.
Whereas he was somebody.
There wasn't a big growth arc or anything.
Yeah, not at all.
I don't know that he grew in the book, but...
Well, I don't... Growth might not have been the right term, but there was... He was drastically different than everyone else. And Artemis was a little bit different, and she figured out some pieces of it. And H was a little bit different, and he or she figured out his or her things. But it was really Wade who brought the whole thing together as this guy who just really believed.
Yes.
And in the movie, it's just, oh, here are these three dudes who just happened to... And the other thing of bringing Dodo and Shoto in as friends from the get-go to make them be the high five, there was no... you know, interesting story arc to their coming together. It's just, oh, these are the five who happen to figure it out.
Yes.
As opposed to it being poignant in any way.
Yeah, exactly. And the other, it's funny, the other thematic point that, like, kind of goes off of Wade Watts, like, rise, like, rags to riches story is that when we're talking about the Sixers and IOI and what they're trying to accomplish, one of the underpinnings, or at least a byproduct of if they were to take over, is that the free education for the world in the Oasis would go away. Mm-hmm. And people wouldn't be able to access all the information they can be able to at the current state of the Oasis. And so they kind of like bypassed that. And I thought that at least that resonated with me as a millennial who has paid for expensive education and stuff like that. And being like, hey, I mean, there was a core kind of motivating component to all of this that he wants to definitely make sure that they also don't take over the Oasis for that specific reason on top of the other reasons. Like, it's like we want to make sure that kids still get to go and just educate themselves or actually have to be able to go to school in the Oasis, all of that stuff. So
exactly.
He took that out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I dislike about book to movie adaptations, when they miss a plot point that I felt was key. I do feel like Wade being the everyman, the poor kid, the level 10, and being able to solve the problem just because he worked hard and was persistent and consistent was a really key element to the first third of the book.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, he just decided to drive his car backwards that one day.
Yeah. Now, the thing that really irritates the hell out of me about that is a buddy of mine and I were playing GoldenEye a long time ago, and my thing is I'm always looking for the secret. Whenever I play a video game, there could be some place like, oh, I'm not supposed to go there. That's where I want to go first. So the first thing I do in any of that genre of first-person shooters is turn around and go backwards, because I want to see, all right, the developer put me facing north in this room from the beginning of the level for a reason. I want to see what happens if I go south.
Do you mean that red balloon in the beginning of Donkey Kong?
The red balloon, I mean, that's one of them. In the Beavis and Butthead game, there's a hamburger hidden behind a pole.
Oh.
I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that you're not supposed to go that direction. Shovel Knight is filled with that kind of thing. I mean, it's almost, at this point, it's almost a trope, like, almost is the wrong word. It is a trope of trying to go above and beyond the borders. So it would seem to me like with all of the references that they're making to this genre of video games, this style, this era of video games, that going in the way that is the opposite of what is expected of you is not going to be where you hide your secret. You're going to hide it
right
in a room that you can't get to unless you do something by going somewhere that's completely innocuous.
Well, it also seemed to cheapen it that they did have the, I don't know, what did they call, like, the memory archive place with the...
Yeah.
Like they
had a
just,
name. I can't remember what it was.
Right.
But
right. They could just go in and, like, watch a video of what happened that day. Like, that's not what the Gunters did.
Yeah.
They were super study nerds.
That's true. Although, yeah, if you really want to talk about utterly ruining the book, I think it comes down to the final challenge.
Okay.
Andrew, did that bother you at all? I'm talking, of course, about adventure.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was one of the most frustrating things of all time. And also, on top of that, sorry, because the whole concept of getting the key and then that's it in the movie,
it
completely sidestepped the notion in the book where, like, you get the key and then you have to actually go do something, another challenge, and then you unlock it with the key.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And so with adventure, that was like the secondary component, and yeah, it was insanely frustrating. I mean, at that point, I was like, like, well, I don't even know what's going to happen now. I guess it's just like a brand new movie because all the characters have met each other in person, and they didn't even have to like struggle that much in order to get to the point where they're at. But yeah, and then like them driving around the ice cream truck and like avoiding the most like surveillance based corporation in the country is a little bit of a naive version of what I think Klein was trying to project.
A little hard to swallow.
Yeah, the drones can't find you if you hide in the alley.
Yeah, right.
Well, if you turn the headlights off anyway.
I suppose.
Right, right.
But, I mean, even if you completely disregard the idea that Agnarak...
Agnarak's Almanac?
Sure. And what was his real name?
Halliday.
James Halliday, yeah.
Okay, so even if you completely disregard the fact that James Halliday in the book mentions the Easter egg inside of Adventure as the archetype for video game Easter eggs, even if you do pretend like, okay, in the movie he doesn't mention Adventure, two things. First off, Adventure is still the archetype, even in the world. We all know about that Easter egg. We all know about the game Adventure. And secondly, you have the Sixer scholars sitting in that room, and one of them even says something to the effect of, Adventure, don't beat the game, you got to get the Easter egg. Well, why didn't she speak up earlier? And then, when they finally do get to the point where he gets the Easter egg, why are these people who work for IOI super duper excited that Wade is the one who figured it out?
was a bit odd at the end. Yeah, I was like, it's really strange.
Okay, so adventure was the part that really irritated me more than I think anything else in the entire book, outside or the movie. Even outside of the fact that the movie was just kind of unimportant.
Right.
I mean, as much as we all griped on how it's not really that great a book, we just really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
This movie took that and just kind of shifted the whole thing down. It was a really not a good movie at all. And I, you know, I kind of liked it. Not a, oh, it's an okay book, but I really liked it.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you think it would have been better if they had stayed in the 80s?
That wouldn't have hurt, but no, I don't think that would have been much better. All of the stuff they added that wasn't exactly from the book, there's only two things I would comment about that, and that would be, well, actually three, two negatives. One is the Iron Giant was a poor choice because the whole point of the Iron Giant is that he's not a weapon.
He's nice, yeah.
Yeah, which, I mean, I can totally understand. He has the weaponry capabilities within him, and yeah, you could reprogram him to be a weapon. That's fine, but it's kind of like getting the point of the story and just destroying the heart of it just because it looks cool.
Well.
Secondly, there's no way that Halliday would have ever played GoldenEye.
Because he would have needed friends?
No, GoldenEye was way after him being interested in playing like, he probably would have thought the Super Nintendo was too advanced.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
N64.
Exactly. But then the one thing I did like was in that final battle, I saw some of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles running around battling.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty rad.
You didn't mention your favorite part of the movie, though.
Well, because you asked me about book to movie and that kind of thing in the 80s.
Okay? Right.
So the question I wanted to ask you guys was there any redeeming characteristics behind this movie? Was there anything that was in the movie that you really liked? Either because you thought, oh, they got that part, they nailed that part, or this was added, and even though it wasn't in the book, I still liked it.
I don't feel that I'm in a position to answer that. Unfortunately, I will watch it.
No,
sober,
yeah,
and feeling well.
I do give them credit for explaining the Oasis in the beginning.
Mm. Okay, yep.
I thought they did a good job, especially for non-readers.
Okay,
understanding it, because the book does. It's actually not a very in-depth explanation in the book. And so, which actually I was surprised at when I went back and like read a little bit of it after the movie. And yeah, so they kind of made it like pretty simple, and they made it that kind of imaginary escape from society. So they really harped on that theme from the book, which is what I liked. Wade Watts somewhat talks about the energy crisis and like why they all live that way in the movie, but it's like super brief.
Yeah.
But yeah, so kind of going back and maybe like the entrance through the goggles into the Oasis, stuff like that. I thought that was pretty cool. I enjoyed that part. And again, that was early on before I had began to realize that there was some drastic differences.
Before you were completely fed up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But as far as like Easter eggs or things that they were harping on, there was a Rush poster, which was, I was really surprised that they didn't do more Rush.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Now Rush mixtape.
There was a Rush poster in H's warehouse. But the other thing was that, sorry, now I'm going off onto what I didn't like, was, I mean, IROC's character, independent of the book, like if I had never read the book, I probably would have been entertained by that character.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But he plays such a larger role in the movie than in the book. I think they want to capitalize off of that character style because they needed a humor enemy as well on top of the head of the IOI. Ben Mendelsohn played him, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. But yeah, anyways, so I like the Oasis description. Stuff beyond that, they kind of dropped the ball on some of the key references, except for maybe the Ninja Turtles.
And how do you get to be head of IOI if you can't even remember your own inane password?
Right.
Is it 1234?
It wasn't quite that inane, but it was close.
Bossman 69.
Yeah, that one.
The bit from The Office. Try Big Boobs with a Z.
Is it this one on the sticky note right here? Password?
Right.
All
you?
Right. I told you I don't feel I'm qualified to answer this question.
All right. So I did really enjoy the second gate or second key where they had to go and do kind of the movie flick sync version of The Shining.
Mm.
First off, I don't think Halliday would have really loved that movie nearly as much as he would have Monty Python or
War Games.
War Games, yes. Or, you know, shoot, even like Lady Hawk or something like that. But I really liked the movie The Shining, and I thought they did a pretty good job with that, and I laughed about it a lot.
You did.
But the really, really funny thing is, when we were at the restaurant before going to see the movie, there was this big mural up on the wall that I hadn't really noticed before, right? In the middle of the mural was a picture of this guy, and we were joking about how we thought it was the head manager from when we got married there, a guy named Greg? George?
Started with a G.
Something like that. So we were joking that that was him. We asked the bartender, hey, does that guy still work here? Nah, he quit years ago. Okay. So we were joking, hey, maybe it's like that picture, that mural. It's kind of like The Shining. Greg doesn't work here anymore, but he's still here, and that's his picture right there. Thought it was funny that we're making Shining references just a couple of hours before seeing this movie that has this long scene where, of course, there you have Halliday right there in the picture, right where Jack Nicholson's character would have been, Jack Torrance.
You laughed really, really hard at that in the theater.
That made me laugh a lot.
It
yes.
made me pick my head up off the table. What is so funny?
And then, of course, I also had to make the Simpson references, which I was kind of disappointed that they didn't do that. And that's strange. The blood usually gets off on the third floor.
Yeah.
I was expecting them to say something about The Simpsons, but I got nothing. But at the very least, I really like the movie The Shining, so seeing it from that perspective was kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
So but which, it was still, I mean, outside of doing lip service, it was still fairly weak.
So what's your takeaway? If you read the book, go ahead and pass.
I mean, you should watch it just because this is, I think this is a really remarkable book to film adaptation in the way that they go about doing it.
Okay.
I've never seen a book to film adaptation quite like this. Typically they either, you know, go like way off the rails, and this one really tried to keep the essence of the story at its core and kind of followed the story in a parallel. But it also, even in following in that parallel, it lost much of the heart of what made it fun. And also, just, it wasn't nearly as good. So, no, I think it's worth watching. What about you, Andrew?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I really think that the continuous references to really kind of core video game culture from the 80s was kind of something that I just tapped into and really enjoyed throughout the entire book. And as we kind of highlighted when we reviewed it before, is that it's not like we're reading the incredible, like the most advanced literature or anything like that. It's just that we're very entertained throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
And yeah. And I didn't find myself to be as entertained throughout the entire film as I was with the book. But again, like, I'm on the same page in terms of them adapting it into a film. And also I went back and looked, and Ernest Cline he co-authored the screenplay for the movie. So,
oh.
It was interesting that he kind of endorsed and maybe even was taking charge in terms of the differences and changes.
He was okay with this, huh?
Yeah. So, and that was the other interesting thing. Oh, actually, sorry, a tiny little anecdote. I didn't even know this when I was going back and doing a little bit of research about the book after the movie, is that Ernest Cline put an Easter egg in Ready Player One. And if you solved it, you got a vintage DeLorean.
What?
And I don't exactly remember what you had to do. Yeah, so it was like you had to go, and it had something to do with some Atari video games where you had to go back, do like complete a high score, record your name, and do that with a couple other things. But it was a total Easter egg in the actual text of the book. And some guy out in the Midwest, he now has a vintage DeLorean because he won it.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That is pretty awesome. A little bit on the meta side. I like it.
Yeah, right. But yeah.
And well, now I need to go read about that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out, too.
We'll have to wrap this up.
Okay.
Final thoughts?
Well, I did want to ask one more question. If you've listened to the podcast, you know that my favorite book-to-film adaptations are Road and The Prestige. Mm-hmm. Do you guys have any favorites or any remarkable ones that you want to shout out while we're on the topic?
Oh.
Mm. I think The Help was one of the better book-to-film adaptations that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
I would possibly say the best. Mm. Season one of A Song of Ice and Fire matched the book really carefully.
I'll allow that.
Well, yeah.
It's not a movie, it's... Yeah.
And then I think that Brooklyn was a better movie than it was a book.
Because
that book was boring.
So the movie was a better movie than the book was a book? Or the movie was just better than the book?
We're going to go with the movie was better than the book.
All right. Those are remarkable. Rare.
They stand out.
But I think that's kind of like, and here we'll foreshadow a future episode, I think that's kind of like Time's Arrow. I think it's just that because of the way pop culture goes, you tend to have popular books that are made into movies so they can be made more accessible.
Mm.
It generally doesn't go the other way around because books tend to be less accessible than movies.
Like Jurassic Park, where they bought the rights before the novel was finished.
Right.
I suppose. Yeah. Was the, I don't really know much of the story behind that, but was the novel altered in any way based on what happened with the screenplay and or the movie?
Well, you've read the book, right?
Well, of course, yes, but
yeah.
That's not going to help me understand the story.
I don't think...
Okay.
I haven't studied that extensively. I don't believe that the ending to the novel was altered to match the movie because they had...
Not match the movie.
Altered
because of the movie. Like, did the screenwriter say, hey, we ought to add this, and Michael Crichton went, oh, that's garbage. I got to write something totally different. or maybe, hey, that's a cool scene. I'll squeeze that one in. Or anything like that.
I'm going to kill Hammond.
Spoilers.
Or not. What about you, Andrew? Notable novel to movie.
I remember American Psycho with Christian Bale.
Yeah.
That was, ironically, maybe The Shining as well. I can lump that in there. But American Psycho, I remember reading that book and being like, wow, this is an incredible book. And then that film was equally amazing. So that was really impressive. And then the one actually that I haven't really talked to many people about who read this book, and this was so long ago that I think that I maybe read like 75% of this book and then saw the movie and loved the movie so much that I actually never went back and finished it, but it was Trainspotting. Yeah, I had read that book, and
that's a good adaptation.
Yeah, it was like the book was good, and then the film was equally as good, if not better. And so I really liked that as well. Those were two good ones.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, I had to throw a little softball up for the Harry Potter movies because I'm a sucker for them.
Yeah, I felt like it's the first two anyway. I felt like they were really true.
Christopher Columbus. Right?
Yeah. You think so?
Yeah. I knew I was probably potentially going to get back on that one.
I will fully own and admit that I, in general, am a book snob. Like, I finished reading Harry Potter with the 8-year-old, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, and we still haven't watched the movie because
I think
I don't want to break the bubble.
Much like A Song of Ice and Fire, like, the first two really followed
the
plot.
Okay. All right.
And the things that they eliminated, not like you could totally write them off, but they were something that you could easily clean up.
All right.
And instead of having this 10-minute long scene, you just have a couple of lines of dialogue that essentially traps the same thing.
Fair enough.
So, and if you listen to the episode where I talked about The Prestige and The Road, there's several different things that you can do in movie to book adaptations to make it work. And the one that I think is, especially if you're making a movie, not like a miniseries or a whole TV series, The one that you kind of have to do is make some kind of omission.
Hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. I don't think, unless you're doing A Christmas Carol, which is another terrific book to movie adaptation. Mm-hmm. Any of them, the Muppets, the Patrick Stewart, the even Scrooged, which is a parody, do a really good job of capturing the essence of the story, as well as not leaving too much out or changing anything. But I always consider that one a cheat because that book is only 80 pages long.
Hmm. Wasn't this going to be like a 15-minute episode?
No, I mean, my thought was that's all we'd have to say. But it's good that we had a lot of...
Turns out nerds go on.
We do. Although this is... I mean, if we stop now, it's going to be one of the shortest episodes we've ever done.
Okay, so it's still a mini-sode. We're
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
We're good, right then.
Anything else to add?
I didn't mean to be a jerk about your Christmas Carol thing.
I didn't think you were a jerk about the Christmas Carol thing. I thought you were a jerk about this episode.
Oh. If I was a jerk about anything, it was about the Christmas Carol thing.
I don't know. I didn't
get
it.
In my defense.
I didn't get it.
In my jerky defense.
Which, you know, going back, how on earth did Charles Dickens write 800 pages about a house that's falling apart and then somehow could only write 80 about Christmas? It's like two totally different authors.
Yep, it really is.
Okay, so I think that's enough for us to go on about Ready Player One and film adaptations in general, or book to film adaptations in general. So if we have nothing else to discuss tonight, I think we can call it a night. Thanks everybody for joining us.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. anovelpodcast@gmail.com or @anovelpodcast. Look forward to hearing from you.
Hey, so Philadelphia, you ever been to the Mutter Museum?
I've honestly never been inside of there. I have like walked with the parade that goes down there on New Year's Day.
Oh yeah.
But I've never gone in, and I've heard it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I have no desire to go, but I do know about it.
Yeah.
What is it? I do not.
How would you describe it? It's a museum of medical oddities.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. I do know about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like things in formaldehyde jars, right?
Right, yeah.
Lots of that.
Like the two-headed lizard or the, like, 13-toed baby or weird.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing there were a lot of babies, which, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Some people aren't into babies in jars.
Right.
I'm probably one of them.
It seems like it would be very unpleasant.
Something I can get behind, you know? I can support
that. We shouldn't take the kids, that's for sure.
You bet.
Oh yeah. No, I have not. I have never been. I don't necessarily have a desire to go.